And as he intends to enter the church at the same time as myself, he does not despair of becoming himself a pope, or at any rate a cardinal. You will understand that a man who has such views will not allow himself to be caught, or, if he should be caught, will rather suffer martyrdom than speak. Very well, said D'Artagnan. I allow you Bazin with all my heart. Only allow me Planchet. Her ladyship once sent him away well caned. Now Planchet has a good memory, and I promise you that if he thought revenge possible, he would allow himself to be broken on the wheel rather than not affect it. If the business at Tours belongs peculiarly to you, that in London is peculiarly mine. So I entreat you to choose Planchet, who has, on his part, already been to London with me, and knows how to say, very correctly, London, sir, if you please, and my master, Lord D'Artagnan. You may be quite sure that with this knowledge he will find his way there and back. In that case, said Athos, Planchet must receive 700 livres for each half of his journey, and Bazin 300. That will reduce the sum to 5,000 livres. We will each take 1,000 livres, to spend as we please, and we will leave a fund of 1,000, of which the abbé shall take care, for extraordinary expenses and our common wants. What do you say to that?
My dear Athos, said Aramis, you speak like Nestor, who was, as everybody knows, the wisest of the Greeks.
Then it is settled, continued Athos. Planchet and Bazin will set out. After all, I am not sorry to keep Grimaud. He is accustomed to my ways, and I could depend upon him. Yesterday's expedition must have rather shaken him already, and this voyage would undo him altogether. Planchet was sent for to receive his instructions. He had already received some intimation of the journey from his master, who had instanced to him first the glory, then the profit, and lastly the danger. "I will carry the letter in the lining of my coat," said Planchet, "and will swallow it if I am taken." "But then you will be unable to perform your commission," said D'Artagnan. "You will give me a copy this evening, which I shall know by heart tomorrow." D'Artagnan looked at his friends as much as to say, "Well, did I not tell you so?" "Now," continued he, addressing Planchet, "you have 8 days to reach Lord de Winter, and 8 days to return here. That is 16 days in all. If on the 16th day from your departure you have not arrived at 8 o'clock in the evening, not a farthing more money shall you have, though you are only later by 5 minutes." "Then, sir," said Planchet, "buy me a watch." "Here, take this," said Athos, with heedless generosity, giving him his own. "And be a brave lad. Consider that if you talk, if you babble, you will sacrifice the head of your master, who has so much confidence in your fidelity that he has answered for you to us. But remember also that if by any fault of yours any such calamity should befall D'Artagnan, I will hunt you out wherever you may be and completely perforate you." "Oh, sir," cried Planchet, humiliated at the suspicion, and particularly alarmed by the calmness of the musketeer. "And I," said Porthos, rolling his great eyes, "remember that I will skin you alive." "Ah, sir!"
"And I," said Aramis, with his soft and melodious voice, "remember that I will roast you at a slow fire, as if you were an untutored savage."
"Ah, sir!"
And Planchet began to cry. But we cannot venture to say whether it was from terror on account of the threats he had heard, or from being affected at seeing so close a union of hearts between the four friends. D'Artagnan took his hand. "You see, Planchet," said he, "that these gentlemen speak thus from affection towards me. But notwithstanding all this, they esteem you."
"Ah, sir," said Planchet, "I shall either succeed or I shall be quartered. And were I even quartered, you may rely upon it that not one piece of me will speak."
It was decided that Planchet should start the next day, at 8 in the morning, in order that, as he said, he might, during the night, have time to learn the letter by heart. He gained just 12 hours by this arrangement, as he was to return at 8 o'clock in the evening of the 16th day. Just as he was about to mount his horse in the morning, D'Artagnan, who felt his heart inclined towards Buckingham, took Planchet aside. "Listen," said he, "when you have delivered your letter to Lord de Winter, and he has read it, say to him, 'Watch over the Duke of Buckingham, for they are seeking to assassinate him.'
But this, do you see, Planchet, is a thing of such momentous importance that I would not even confess to my friends that I have confided the secret to you. And even for a captain's commission, I would not write it down.
Be easy, sir, said Planchet. You shall see whether you can trust me.
Mounted on an excellent horse, which he was to leave at 20 leagues from La Rochelle, to take the post, Planchet went off at a gallop. His heart was a little shaken by the threats of the musketeers, but on the whole he was in a most favourable state of mind. Bazin left the next morning for Tours, and had 8 days allowed him for his expedition. The four friends, during the whole time of their absence, had, as may be well supposed, their eyes more than ever on the watch, their noses in the wind, and their ears upon the alert. The days were consumed in trying to catch every report, to watch the movements of the cardinal, and to scent out the couriers who arrived. More than once an unconquerable anxiety seized them on being sent for on some unexpected service. They had also to be watchful of their own safety. Her ladyship was a phantom who, having once appeared to anyone, would never more allow him to sleep in tranquillity. On the morning of the 8th day, Bazin, fresh as ever, and smiling as usual, entered the room at the Parpaillot, just as the four friends were sitting down to breakfast, saying, according to the agreement they had made,
"Monsieur Aramis, here is the answer from your cousin."
The four friends exchanged a joyful glance. Half their work was done. It is true that it was the shortest and easiest half. Aramis took the letter, blushing in spite of himself. The writing was vulgar, and the spelling wretched.
"Good God!" said he, laughing. "I decidedly despair of her. This poor Michon will never write like Monsieur de Voiture."
"Who does that mean, this poor Michon?"
asked the Swiss, who was commencing a gossip with the four friends when the letter was brought.
"Oh, mon Dieu, less than nothing," replied Aramis. "She is a charming little seamstress, whom I was very much in love with, and from whom I have begged a few lines, in her own handwriting, by way of remembrance."
"Egad," said the Swiss, "if she is as ladylike as her own penmanship, you must be a happy fellow, comrade."
Aramis read the letter, and handed it to Athos.
"Just see what she writes, Athos," said he.
Athos threw a glance over the letter, and then, to destroy any suspicions which might have been awakened, read it aloud.
"Cousin, my sister and I understand dreams very well, and we are shocking frightened at them. But of yours, it may be said, I hope, all dreams are false. Adieu. Take care of yourself, and let us hear of you from time to time. Marie Michon."
"What dream is she talking about?"
asked the dragoon, who had approached whilst they were reading the letter.
"Yes, what dream?" said the Swiss.
"Oh, vive Dieu," said Aramis. "It is plain enough. About a dream of mine that I told them."
"Ah, yes," said the Swiss. "It is quite natural to tell one's dreams, but for my part, I never dream at all."
"You are very fortunate," said Athos, rising, "and I wish I could say the same thing."
"Never,"
repeated the Swiss, delighted that a man like Athos should envy him in anything.
"Never, never."
D'Artagnan, seeing Athos rise, did the same, and took his arm and left the room. Porthos and Aramis remained behind to face the gossip of the Swiss and the dragoon. As for Bazin, he went to sleep upon a truss of straw, and, as he had more imagination than the Swiss, dreamt that Monsieur Aramis, who had become Pope, was placing on his head a cardinal's hat. But, as we have already said, Bazin had, by his fortunate return, removed only a part of the uneasiness which tormented the four friends. The days of suspense are always long, and D'Artagnan especially could have sworn that each of these days was 8-40 hours long. He forgot the unavoidable delays of navigation. He exaggerated the power of her ladyship. He gave to this woman, who appeared to him to resemble a demon, auxiliaries as supernatural as herself. And he fancied at every noise that they were coming to arrest him, or were bringing Planchet to be confronted with himself and his friends. And more than that, his extraordinary confidence in the worthy Picard diminished day by day. This suspense was so powerful that it infected Porthos and Aramis. Athos alone remained unmoved, as though no danger filled the air around him, and he breathed in his habitual atmosphere. On the 16th day, particularly, these signs of agitation were so perceptible in D'Artagnan and his two friends that they could not remain in any one place, and wandered about like shadows on the road by which Planchet was expected to return.
This is the end of disc number 15. Please insert disc number 16. This is disc number 16.
On the 16th day, particularly, these signs of agitation were so perceptible in D'Artagnan and his two friends that they could not remain in any one place, and wandered about like shadows on the road by which Planchet was expected to return.
"Really," said Athos, "you are not men. You are only children to let a woman frighten you so much. And after all, what is it that you fear? Imprisonment? Well, we should be released from prison, as Madame Bonancieux has been. Execution? Why, we gladly expose ourselves every day in the trenches to worse than that, for a bullet might break a leg. And I'm quite sure that a surgeon puts one to more pain in amputating a thigh than an executioner in cutting off a head. So keep yourselves easy. In 2, 4, 6 hours at the latest, Planchet will be here. He has given us his promise, and I, for my part, have great confidence in the promises of Planchet, for he seems to me a very worthy lad."
"But what if he should not come?" said D'Artagnan.
"Well, and if he should not come, he has been delayed, that's all. He may have fallen from his horse, he may have made a somersault over a bridge, he may have brought on a disease of his chest by running too quickly. Come, gentlemen, let us allow for accidents. Life is a large chaplet of little miseries, which the philosopher shakes with a laugh. Be philosophers like me, gentlemen. Come around the table and let us drink. Nothing makes the future of so rosy a hue as to look at it through a glass of Chambertin."
"That is all very well," replied D'Artagnan, "but I am weary of imagining every time I drink that the wine may have come from her ladyship's cellar."
"You are very fastidious," said Athos. "Such a beautiful woman."
"A woman with a brand," said Porthos with his hoarse laugh.
Athos started, passed his hand over his forehead to wipe off the perspiration, and rose in his turn with a nervous agitation that he was unable to restrain. The day, however, glided on, and the evening came more slowly. But at last it arrived. The taverns were full of customers. Athos, who had pocketed his share of the diamond, now scarcely ever left the Parpaillot. He had found in Monsieur de Busigny, who, moreover, had given them a superb dinner, a partner worthy of himself. They were playing together, according to custom, when the clock struck 7, and they heard the patrols passing to change the guard. At 7:30, the drums beat the last post.
"We are lost," whispered D'Artagnan in Athos's ear.
"You mean to say that we have lost," replied Athos, with great tranquillity, drawing at the same time 10 pistoles from his pocket and throwing them upon the table. "Come, gentlemen," continued he, "that is the last drum. Let us go to bed." And Athos left the Parpaillot, followed by D'Artagnan. Aramis came behind, giving his arm to Porthos. Aramis was mouthing verses, and Porthos, from time to time, tore a few hairs from his moustache in token of despair. But behold, suddenly, in the obscurity, a shadow was perceptible, of a form familiar to D'Artagnan, and a well-known voice said to him, "Sir, I have brought you your cloak, for it is cold this evening."
"Planchet!"
exclaimed D'Artagnan, intoxicated with joy.
"Planchet!"
exclaimed Aramis and Porthos.
"Well, yes, Planchet," said Athos. "What is there surprising in that? He promised to be back by 8 o'clock, and it is now just striking 8. Bravo, Planchet! You are a lad of your word, and if ever you leave your master, I will keep a place for you in my service."
"Oh, no, never," said Planchet. "I shall never leave Monsieur D'Artagnan."
And at the same moment, D'Artagnan felt Planchet slip a small note into his hand. D'Artagnan had a great desire to embrace Planchet, but he was afraid such a mark of delight, conferred upon his valet in the public highway, would look rather odd to any passer-by, so he restrained himself. "I have got the letter," said he to Athos and his friends. "Very well," said Athos. "Let us go to our quarters and read it." The letter burned the hand of D'Artagnan. He wished to hurry on, but Athos kept a firm hold of his arm, and the young man was compelled to regulate his speed by that of his friend. They reached their tent at last, and lighted a lamp, and whilst Planchet stood at the door to see that the four friends were not interrupted, D'Artagnan, with a trembling hand, broke the seal and opened the long-expected letter. It contained half a line in a hand truly British, and of a brevity truly Spartan. "Thank you. Be easy." Athos took the letter from D'Artagnan's hands, put it to the lamp, lighted it, and did not quit his hold until it was reduced to ashes. Then, calling Planchet, "Now, my boy," said he, "you have a right to the other 700 livres. But you did not run much risk with such a letter as that." "Nevertheless, I have invented a great many ways of securing it," replied Planchet. "Well," said D'Artagnan, "tell us all about it."
"But it is a long story, sir," answered he.
"You are right, Planchet," said Athos. "Besides, the last drum has sounded, and we shall be observed if we burn our light longer than other people." "Well, then, let us go to bed," said D'Artagnan. "Sleep well, Planchet."
"Faith, sir, it will be my first time for 16 days."
"And mine also," said D'Artagnan.
"And mine too,"
exclaimed Porthos.
"And mine too," re-echoed Aramis.
"Well, shall I confess the truth?"
"And mine too," said Athos.
49. Fatality. In the meantime, her ladyship, intoxicated with rage, and raging on the vessel's deck like an excited lioness, had been even tempted to cast herself into the sea, for she could not bring herself to brook the thought that she had been insulted by D'Artagnan and threatened by Athos, and was now quitting France without having obtained revenge. So insupportable had this idea at last become, that, at the risk of the most terrible consequences to herself, she had entreated the captain to land her on the French coast. But the captain, anxious to escape from his false position, where he was placed between the English and French cruisers like a bat between the rats and the birds, was in extreme haste to arrive in England. He obstinately refused, therefore, to obey what he regarded as a woman's caprice. He promised, however, to his passenger, who had been particularly recommended to his care by the cardinal, to land her at some port in Brittany, either Brest or Lorient, should the weather and the French permit. But in the meantime, the wind was contrary and the sea rough. They tacked about continually, and 9 days after her departure from Charente, her ladyship, pale with grief and rage, saw only the blue shores of Finisterre. She calculated that to traverse that angle of France and return to the cardinal would take her at least 3 days. Add 1 day for landing, and that would make 4. Add these 4 to the 9 already elapsed, and here were 13 days lost, 13 days during which so many important events might have occurred in London. She considered that the cardinal would undoubtedly be furious at her return, and consequently would be disposed to listen more to any accusations which were made against her than to those which she might make against others. Without solicitation, therefore, she permitted the captain to carry her past Lorient and Brest, and he, on his part, was careful not to remind her of her wishes. She thus continued her voyage, and on the very day that Planchet embarked at Portsmouth to return to France, the messenger of His Eminence entered the port triumphantly. The whole town was in a state of extraordinary excitement. 4 large ships, recently built, had just been launched into the sea. Standing on the jetty, covered with gold, and glittering as usual with diamonds and precious stones, his hat adorned with a white plume which dropped upon his shoulder, Buckingham was visible, surrounded by a staff almost as gorgeous as himself. It was one of those few and fine summer days when Englishmen remember that there is a sun. The pale but still splendid luminary was just setting on the horizon, empurpling the heavens and the sea with bands of fire, and casting a last golden ray on the towers and the old buildings of the town, which made the windows gleam as with the reflection of a conflagration. Her ladyship, as she inhaled the sea breeze, which is fresher and more balmy in the vicinity of land, and contemplated all those mighty preparations which she was ordered to destroy, and all the might of that armament against which she had come to contend alone, a woman with a few bags of gold, mentally compared herself to Judith, the terrible Jewess, when she penetrated into the camp of the Assyrians, and saw the enormous mass of chariots, of horses, of men, and of arms, which one movement of her hand was to dissipate like a cloud of smoke. They entered the roads, but just as they were making ready to cast anchor, a small, strongly armed cutter, presenting itself as a coast guard, approached the merchant vessel, and put off its gig, which was steered toward them. The gig contained an officer, a lieutenant, and 8 men. The officer alone came on board, where he was received with all the respect which his uniform inspired. The officer conversed for a few minutes with the captain, and inspected some papers which the latter brought with him. And then, on the captain's order, all the crew and passengers of the vessel were mustered upon deck. When this had been done, the officer inquired aloud as to where the brig had come from, what had been its course, and where it had put in. And to all these questions the captain replied satisfactorily, without hesitation or difficulty. The officer then began to examine all the persons on deck, one after the other, and stopping before her ladyship, he looked at her very earnestly, but without uttering a single word. Having returned to the captain and made some new communication to him, the officer, as if he had now taken command of the vessel, gave an order which the crew immediately executed. By this means the vessel was again in motion, but it was still escorted by the little cutter, which kept beside it, menacing its broadside with the mouths of her cannons. The boat followed in the vessel's wake, an object scarcely visible behind the enormous mass. Whilst the officer had been examining her ladyship, she, as may be well imagined, had on her side not failed to scrutinize him most intently. But however much this woman, with her eye of fire, was accustomed to read the hearts of those whose secret she desired to discover, she had found at last a countenance so perfectly impenetrable that no insight followed her investigation. The officer who stood before her and silently studied her with so much care might be about 25 or 26 years of age. He had a very fair complexion, with blue eyes rather deeply set. His fine and well-cut mouth continued perfectly motionless in its classic lines. His well-developed chin denoted that strength of will which, in the prevailing English character, is commonly no better than obstinacy, and his slightly receding forehead, such as is accorded to poets, to enthusiasts, and to soldiers, was scantily shaded by short, thin hair, which, as well as the beard that covered the lower part of his face, was of a beautiful, deep chestnut colour. When they entered the harbour, it was already dark. The fog increased the obscurity, and formed around the lanterns of the ships and jetties a circle similar to that which surrounds the moon when it threatens rainy weather. The atmosphere was melancholy, damp, and cold. Her ladyship, firm as she was, felt herself shivering in spite of all her efforts. The officer had had her ladyship's packages indicated to him, and ordered them to be put into the boat, after which, offering his hand to assist her, he requested her to descend herself. Her ladyship looked at the man and hesitated. "Who are you, sir," said she, "who are so good as to trouble yourself so particularly about me?" "You may see, madam, from my uniform, that I am an officer in the English Navy," replied the young man. "But is it usual for the officers of the English Navy to put themselves at the service of their countrywomen when they approach a British port, and to display their gallantry so far as to conduct them on shore?" "Yes, my lady, it is the custom. Not from gallantry, but prudence, that in time of war strangers may be conducted to a certain appointed hotel, in order that they may, until every information be obtained concerning them, remain under the inspection of the government." The words were uttered with the most exact politeness and the most perfect calmness, and yet they did not satisfy her ladyship. "But I am not a foreigner, sir," said she, in an accent as pure as was ever uttered between Portsmouth and Manchester. "My name is Lady de Winter, and this proceeding—" "This proceeding is general, my lady, and you will in vain endeavour to escape it."
"I will follow you then, sir."
And, accepting the officer's hand, she began to descend the ladder, at the bottom of which the boat was waiting. The officer followed her. A large cloak was spread in the stern. The officer made her seat herself on it, and placed himself by her side. "Give way," said he to the sailors. The 8 oars all fell into the water at the same instant, and the boat seemed to fly along the surface of the harbour. In 5 minutes they reached the shore. The officer sprang upon the quay and gave his hand to her ladyship. A carriage was waiting for them.
"Is this carriage for us?"
demanded the lady. "Yes, madam," replied the officer.
"Then the hotel is at some distance?"
"At the other end of the town."
"Let us go,"
said her ladyship. She then entered the carriage with a resolute step. Having superintended the safe consignment of the baggage, the officer took his place beside her ladyship and closed the carriage door. Then, without any orders being given to him, or any indication as to where he was to go, the coachman set off at a gallop, and was soon threading the streets of the town. A reception so strange naturally supplied her ladyship with abundant matter for reflection, and seeing that the young officer did not appear at all inclined to enter into conversation, she leant back in one of the corners of the carriage, and passed in review, one after the other, all the suppositions which presented themselves to her mind. But in about a quarter of an hour, surprised at the length of their journey, she looked out of the window to observe where they were going. She could no longer see any houses, but trees were visible in the darkness, like vast black phantoms chasing one another. Her ladyship shuddered.
"But we have left the town, sir," she remarked.
The young officer remained silent.
"I positively declare, sir, that I will go no further if you do not tell me where you are conveying me."
This threat produced no reply.
"Ah, it is too much!" exclaimed her ladyship. "Help! Help!"
No voice responded to her cries. The carriage continued its rapid course. The officer seemed to be a statue. Her ladyship gazed on him with one of those terrible glances which were peculiar to her own face, and which so rarely failed of their effect. Passion made her eyes positively sparkle in the gloom, but the young man continued perfectly immovable. She then attempted to open the door and throw herself out. "Take care, madam," coldly observed the officer. "You will kill yourself if you leap out." The lady resumed her seat, foaming with rage. He leant forwards, looked at her in his turn, and seemed surprised to find a countenance, before so beautiful, now so convulsed with rage, as to have become almost hideous. The crafty creature, comprehending that she would sacrifice her own interests by thus betraying her true nature, at once composed her features, and, in a beseeching voice, said,
"For heaven's sake, sir, tell me if it be to yourself, or to your government, or to an enemy, that I am to impute this violence that is inflicted on me."
"No violence is inflicted, madam, and that which has befallen you is the result of a very simple measure, which we are forced to pursue towards all those who land in England."
"Then you do not know me, sir?"
"It is the first time that I have had the honour of seeing you."
"And upon your honour, you have no cause of enmity against me?"
"None whatever, I swear." There was so much calmness, so much serenity, so much gentleness even, in the young man's voice, that her ladyship was reassured. At last, after about an hour's drive, the carriage stopped at an iron gate, at the entrance of a narrow road, which led to a gloomy-looking, massive and isolated castle. And as the carriage wheels rolled over a soft gravel, her ladyship heard a mighty roaring, which she recognized as the sound of the sea breaking upon a rocky coast. The carriage passed under two arches, and stopped at last in a square and gloomy courtyard. The door was almost immediately opened. The young officer leapt lightly out, presented his arm to her ladyship, who leaned upon it, and got out, in her turn, with great calmness.
"So, I am a prisoner," said she, looking around, and then fixing her eyes on the young man with the most gracious smile imaginable. "But I shall not be one long, I am certain," added she. "My own conscience and your politeness give me that assurance, sir."
Flattering as the compliment might be, the officer made no reply, but drawing from his pocket a small silver whistle, like those used by boatswains on board men-of-war, he sounded it 3 times, in 3 different modulations. Several men immediately appeared, who unharnessed the horses and took the carriage into a coach-house. The officer, still preserving the same calm politeness, invited his prisoner to enter the castle. The latter, with the same smile upon her countenance, took his arm and passed with him under a low arched doorway, which led them through a vault lighted only at the end to a stone staircase winding round an angle of the same material. They then stopped before a massive door, which, upon the application of a key that the young man carried, slowly swung upon its hinges and gave access to the apartment intended for her ladyship. In one glance, the prisoner grasped the minutest particulars of this room. It was a chamber of which the furniture was at the same time suitable for a prison and for the habitation of the free. But the bars to the windows and the locks outside the doors decided the question in favor of the prison. For an instant, all the strength of mind of this creature, although hardened from the most vigorous sources, abandoned her. She sank into a seat, folded her arms, drooped her head, and waited in momentary expectation of seeing a judge enter to interrogate her. But no one came, except two or three marines, who brought in her baggage, and having deposited it in a corner, withdrew without uttering a word. The officer presided over all these details with the same calmness which her ladyship had invariably observed, not speaking a syllable, and enforcing obedience merely by a gesture of his hand or a note from his whistle. One would have said that between this man and his inferiors, verbal language either had never existed or had become unnecessary. Her ladyship could at last no longer restrain herself, and she thus broke the silence.
"In heaven's name, sir," she exclaimed, "what does all this mean? Relieve my perplexity. I have courage to face any danger which I can see approaching, any misfortune which I comprehend. Where am I, and why am I here? Am I free? Wherefore these bars and doors? Am I a prisoner? What crime have I committed?"
"You are here, madam, in the apartment destined for you. I was ordered to go and arrest you at sea and to conduct you to this castle. I have accomplished that order, I think, with the rigid exactitude of an officer, but at the same time with the courtesy of a gentleman. There terminates, at least for the present, the charge with which I have been entrusted concerning you. The remainder devolves upon another person."
"And this other person, who is he?" demanded her ladyship. "Can you not tell me his name?"
As she spoke, the clashing of spurs was heard upon the staircase. Some voices passed by and were lost in the distance, and the sound of a solitary step approached the door.
"That person is now here, madam," said the officer, standing on one side and assuming an attitude of submission and respect.
At the same instant the door opened, and a man appeared upon the threshold. He was without a hat, carried a sword at his side, and was crushing a handkerchief between his fingers. Her ladyship thought that she recognized this shadow in the gloom, and supporting herself with one hand on the arm of the chair, she advanced her head, in order, as it were, to meet a certainty. The stranger slowly approached, and as he advanced and gradually came within range of the rays emitted by the lamp, her ladyship involuntarily recoiled, and then, when she had no longer any doubt,
"What? My brother!" she exclaimed, overwhelmed with astonishment. "Is it you?"
"Yes, fair lady," replied Lord de Winter, making her a bow, half courteous and half ironical. "Myself."
"But then this castle
is mine."
"This apartment
is yours."
"Then I am your prisoner?"
"Or something very like it."
"But it is a frightful abuse of power."
"No hard words, madam. Let us sit down and have some quiet conversation, as is suitable between brother and sister." Then, turning towards the door, and perceiving that the young officer awaited his final orders, "It is all right," said he. "I thank you. Now leave us, Mr. Felton."
50. A Chat Between a Brother and Sister. During the time which Lord de Winter occupied in shutting and bolting the door, and bringing a seat beside the easy chair of his sister-in-law, her ladyship was thoughtfully directing her glance into the depths of possibility, and discovering the whole of that plot, of which she could form no conception, so long as she continued ignorant of the person into whose hands she had unhappily fallen. She knew her brother-in-law to be a true gentleman, who was fond of the chase, played freely, and was gallant in regard to women, but of powers below the average in respect to intrigues. How had he been able to know of her arrival, and to have her arrested, and why did he desire to detain her? Athos had let fall a few words, which proved that her conversation with the cardinal had been heard by other ears, but she could not imagine that he could so promptly and so boldly lay a countermine. She rather feared that her former proceedings in England had been discovered. Buckingham might have guessed that it was she who had cut off his diamond studs, and have sought to avenge himself for that petty treachery.
but Buckingham was incapable of any extremities against a woman, especially if that woman was supposed to have been actuated by a sentiment of jealousy. This supposition appeared the most probable. She thought that they wished to revenge the past, and not to anticipate the future. But at any rate, she congratulated herself on having fallen into the hands of her brother-in-law, with whom she contemplated little difficulty, rather than into those of a former enemy. "Yes, brother, let us have some chat," she said, with a sort of sprightliness, determined as she was to draw from this conversation, in spite of all the dissimulation which Lord de Winter might bring to it, such information as she needed to guide her future conduct. "You have made up your mind, then, to return to England," said Lord de Winter. "In spite of the determination you so often expressed to me in Paris, never again to set your foot upon the territory of Great Britain?" Her ladyship replied to this question by another. "First tell me," said she, "how you could manage to have me watched so closely, as not only to know beforehand that I was coming, but also the day, the hour, and the port at which I should arrive?" Lord de Winter adopted the same tactics as her ladyship, thinking that, as his sister-in-law employed them, they were undoubtedly the best. "But tell me yourself, my dear sister, for what purpose you are come to England?" "Why, I have come to see you," replied the lady, ignorant of how much she aggravated by this answer the suspicions which D'Artagnan's letter had excited in her brother-in-law's mind, and only wishing to captivate the kindness of her auditor by a lie. "Oh! To see me," said Lord de Winter, sneeringly. "Assuredly to see you. What is there surprising in that?" "And you had no other motive in coming to England than to see me?"
"No."
"Then it is for my sake alone that you have given yourself the trouble to cross the straits?"
"For you alone."
"I'faith, your tenderness is excessive, my dear sister."
"But am I not your nearest relation?" demanded the lady, in a tone of the most touching simplicity.
"And you are also my sole heiress, are you not?" said Lord de Winter, in his turn fixing his eyes upon those of her ladyship. "That is to say, through your son."
Great as was her power of self-command, her ladyship could not refrain from starting, and as, in uttering these last words, Lord de Winter had laid his hand upon his sister's arm, this start had not escaped him. In truth, the blow was both direct and deep. The first idea in the lady's mind was that Kitty had betrayed her, and had disclosed to the Baron that interested aversion whose manifestation she had imprudently permitted to escape her before her maid. And she also recollected the furious and impolitic attack which she had made on D'Artagnan after he had saved her brother-in-law's life.
"I do not understand what you mean, my lord," said she, wishing to gain time and to make her adversary talk. "Is there some concealed signification in your words?"
"Oh, no," said Lord de Winter, with apparent good humour. "You wish to see me, and you come to England. I am informed of this wish, or rather, I suspect that you feel it, and, to spare you all the inconvenience consequent on a nocturnal arrival in the harbour, and all the fatigues of landing, I send one of my officers to meet you. I put a carriage at your disposal, and he brings you here to this castle, of which I am the governor, where I come every day, and where, to satisfy our mutual desire of seeing one another, I have had an apartment prepared for your reception. What is there in all this more surprising than in what you have told me?"
"No, but what surprises me is that you should have received previous intelligence of my arrival."
"And yet it is the simplest thing in the world, my dear sister. Did you not observe that on entering the roads the captain of your little vessel sent forward his log-book and the register of his passengers and crew, that he might obtain permission to enter the port? I am the governor of the port. This book was brought to me, and I recognized your name. My heart told me what your speech has just confirmed. That is to say, your motive for thus braving the dangers of a sea so perilous, or at any rate so fatiguing, at this season, and I sent out my cutter to convey you. You know what followed."
Her ladyship was satisfied that his lordship lied, and she was only the more alarmed.
"Brother," said she, "was not that the Duke of Buckingham whom I saw on the jetty as I disembarked?"
"Himself," replied Lord de Winter. "Oh, I can well imagine that the sight of him would strike you. You come from a country where they must think a good deal about him. And I know that his armaments against France much engage the attention of your friend, the Cardinal."
"My friend, the Cardinal?"
exclaimed the lady, perceiving that on this point also, as on the other, Lord de Winter seemed to be equally well informed.
"Is he not your friend, then?" carelessly inquired the Baron.
"Oh, pardon me, I thought he was. But we will discuss his grace hereafter. Let us not abandon the sentimental turn which the conversation has taken. You came, you say, to see me?"
"Yes."
"Well, I have told you that your wish shall be gratified, and that we shall see one another every day."
"Must I then remain here for ever?" demanded the lady, with some degree of dread.
"Do you find yourself badly lodged here, my dear sister? Ask for what you want, and I will hasten to provide it."
"But I have neither my own women nor my servants with me here."
"You shall have everything you want of that kind. Only tell me what kind of establishment your first husband kept for you, and although I am but your brother-in-law, I will fix your present home upon a similar footing."
"My first husband!"
exclaimed the lady, looking at Lord de Winter with wildness in her eyes.
"Yes, your French husband. I do not mean my own brother. But if you have forgotten it, as he is yet alive, I can write to him, and he can send me the necessary information on the subject."
Cold drops rolled down her ladyship's forehead.
"You are jesting,"
said she, in a hoarse voice.
"Do I look like it?"
inquired the Baron, rising and retreating a step.
"Or rather, you mean to insult me," continued she, convulsively grasping the arms of her chair and raising herself by that means.
"I insult you?" said Lord de Winter contemptuously. "And do you really think that possible, madam?"
"Sir," said her ladyship, "you are either drunk or mad. Leave me and send me my women."
"Women are very indiscreet, my dear sister. Cannot I serve you as a waiting maid? And thus all our secrets will remain in the family."
"Insolent fellow!" exclaimed her ladyship.
Then, as if moved by a spring, she bounded towards the Baron, who awaited her with composure, yet with a hand upon the hilt of his sword.
Ah, said he. "I know that you have a habit of assassinating people, but I will defend myself, I warn you, even against you."
"Ah, you are right," said the lady. "And you look to me like one who is coward enough to raise his hand against a woman.
And if I did, I should have an excuse. Besides, mine would not be the first man's hand that had been laid upon you, I imagine."
And the Baron, by a slow, accusing gesture, pointed to the lady's left shoulder, which he almost touched with his finger. Her ladyship uttered a hoarse cry and retreated to the further corner of the room, like a panther drawing back before its spring.
"Oh, roar as much as you please," exclaimed Lord de Winter. "Only do not try to bite, for I warn you that would only prove the worse for you. There are no lawyers here who regulate successions beforehand. There is no knight-errant who will pick a quarrel with me for the sake of the fair lady whom I keep imprisoned. But I have at hand judges that will dispose of a woman who, being already married, was shameless enough to intrude herself into our family. And these judges will hand you over to an executioner who will make your two shoulders alike."
The eyes of her ladyship shot forth such lightning glances that although he was an armed man before an unarmed woman, he felt the chill of fear penetrating his very soul. Nevertheless, he continued, but with increasing fury,
"Yes, I understand. After having inherited my brother's property, you would like to inherit mine also. But be assured in advance, though you may be able to assassinate me, or to get me assassinated, my precautions are already taken. Not one penny of what I possess shall come either into your hands or into those of your son. Are you not already wealthy enough in the enjoyment of nearly 500,000? And can you not arrest yourself in your fatal course if you do not really do wickedness from a limitless and intense love of it? Oh, doubt not, if my brother's memory had not been still sacred to me, that you should be sent to rot in some dungeon of the state, or to satiate the curiosity of the mob at Tyburn. I shall, however, be silent, but you must learn to endure your confinement with tranquillity. In a fortnight or 3 weeks I shall set out with the army for La Rochelle. But on the evening before my departure, you will be sent on board a vessel, which I shall watch set sail, and which will convey you to one of our southern colonies. and you may rely upon it that I shall associate with you a companion who will blow out your brains on the first attempt that you make to return to England or to the continent."
Her ladyship listened with an attention that expanded the pupils of her burning eyes.
"Yes," continued Lord de Winter, "but at present you will continue in this castle. The walls are thick, the doors are strong, the bars are solid. And besides, your window looks directly down into the sea. My ship's company, who are devoted to me in life and death, keep guard around this chamber, and command every passage that conducts into the courtyard. And even there you would find three iron-grated doors, to pass which the watchword is requisite. Hence, therefore, a step, a motion, or a word which bears the semblance of an intention to escape will draw their fire upon you. If you should be killed, English justice ought, I think, to be grateful to me for having spared her some trouble. Ah, your features have resumed their composure, and your countenance regains its confidence. 10 days or a fortnight, you say to yourself. Ah, by that time some idea will suggest itself to my inventive mind. I have an infernal disposition, and shall find some victim. Within a fortnight from this time, I shall have escaped from here. Well, try your fortune."
Finding her thoughts thus plainly read, her ladyship dug her nails into her flesh, that she might deprive her face of every expression but that of agony. Lord de Winter continued,
"As to the officer who holds the command here in my absence, you have seen him, therefore you already know him. You are aware that he can keep to his instructions, for you did not travel from Portsmouth here without trying to make him talk. What think you of him? Could a marble statue be more impassive or mute? You have already tried the power of your seductions over many men, and unfortunately you have always succeeded. But try it now on this man, and, by Jove, if you succeed, I shall believe you to be the very fiend himself."
He went towards the door and opened it suddenly.
"Call Mr. Felton," said he. And again, "Wait a moment, madam, and I will recommend you to his care."
During the strange silence which was then maintained between them, the sound of a slow and regular step was heard approaching. In the shadow of the corridor a human form was soon apparent, and the young lieutenant, with whom we have already made acquaintance, stood at the door in waiting for the baron's orders.
"Come in, my dear John," said Lord de Winter. "Come in and shut the door."
The young officer entered the room.
"Now," said the baron, "look at this woman. She is young and beautiful. She has every worldly attraction. But she is a monster, who, at 25 years of age, has committed as many crimes as you could read of in a year in the archives of our tribunals. Her voice prepossesses you in her favor. Her beauty fascinates her victims. She will attempt to seduce you, perhaps to kill you. I have rescued you from misery, Felton. I have had you made lieutenant. I have once saved your life. You remember on what occasion. I am not only your protector, but your friend. Not only your benefactor, but your father. This woman has come to England to plot against my life. I have got the serpent into my power. Well, I call you here, and I say to you, my dear Felton, John, my son, defend me and guard yourself especially from this woman. Swear that you will preserve her for the punishment that she deserves. John Felton, I trust to your word. John Felton, I confide in your honor."
"My lord," answered the young officer, exhibiting on his open face all the hatred for the lady that he could find in his heart, "I swear to you that everything shall be done as you desire." Her ladyship received this look like a resigned victim. It was impossible to see a softer or more submissive expression than that which then reigned upon her beautiful face. Scarcely could Lord de Winter himself recognize the tigress which he had the instant before almost prepared to fight.
"She must never leave this room. Do you hear, John?" continued the baron. "She must have no communication with anyone. She must speak to no one but yourself, if, indeed, you will do her the honor to talk with her."
"It is quite enough, my lord. I have sworn."
"And now, madam," said the baron, "endeavor to make your peace with God, for you have been judged by men."
Her ladyship let her head droop, as if she felt herself actually crushed by this sentence. Lord de Winter left the room, making a sign to Felton, who followed him and closed the door. Directly afterwards was heard in the passage the heavy tread of a marine who was keeping guard, with his axe at his belt and his musket in his hand. Her ladyship remained for a few minutes in the same position, for she fancied that they might be watching her through the keyhole. Then she slowly raised her head, which had resumed a formidable expression of menace and defiance, ran to the door and listened, looked out of the window, and returned to bury herself in an immense easy chair and abandon herself to anxious consideration. 51. The Officer. In the meantime, the Cardinal was expecting news from England, but as no news arrived, excepting such as was vexatious and alarming, La Rochelle was formally invested. However certain success appeared, thanks to the precautions which had been taken, and more especially to the mole, which no longer permitted any vessel to approach the besieged town, the blockade might yet continue a long time. And it was a great affront to the arms of the king, and a great annoyance to the cardinal, who had no longer, it is true, to embroil Louis XIII with Anne of Austria, for that had been accomplished, but to reconcile Monsieur de Bassompierre, who had quarrelled with the Duke of Angoulême. The town, in spite of the incredible persistence of its mayor, had attempted a sort of mutiny in order to surrender, but the mayor had sent the mutineers to be hung. This execution subdued the most unruly, who were thereby determined to submit, in preference, to death from starvation, as the latter mode of dying appeared to them less certain and more slow than that of strangulation. The besiegers, on their side, occasionally captured some of the messengers whom the Rochellois dispatched to Buckingham, or the spies whom Buckingham had sent to the Rochellois. In both cases, the captives were subjected to a summary trial. The cardinal pronounced the single word, "Hung." His Majesty was invited to the execution. The king came languidly, and chose a good place for observing all the details of the operation. This amused him for a time, and gave him a little patience with the siege, but it did not prevent him from becoming heartily weary, or from talking incessantly of returning to Paris. So that if the messengers or spies had fallen short, his eminence, in spite of all his fertility of imagination, would have found himself in very considerable embarrassment. Nevertheless, the time passed away, and still the Rochellois did not surrender. The last spy who had been captured was the bearer of a letter, which informed Buckingham that the town was at the last extremity. But instead of adding, "If your assistance should not arrive before a fortnight, we must surrender," it merely said, "If your assistant should not arrive before a fortnight, we shall be all dead from hunger when it does arrive." The Rochellois, therefore, had no hope but in Buckingham. Buckingham was their messiah. It was manifest that, if they should receive indubitable information that no further dependence was to be placed on Buckingham, their courage would forsake them, along with their hope. The cardinal, on this account, waited with extreme impatience for intelligence from England, which might announce to him that Buckingham would not arrive. The question of taking the town by assault, which had been often debated in the king's council, had been always dismissed. In the first instance, La Rochelle appeared to be impregnable, and then the cardinal, whatever he might himself have said about it aloud, was well aware that the horror of the blood which would have been shed in such an encounter, where Frenchmen fought against Frenchmen, would have been a retrogression of 60 years imprinted on his policy. And the cardinal was, at that epoch, what we now call a man of progress. In fact, the sack of La Rochelle, and the slaughter of 3,000 or 4,000 Huguenots who would have perished, would have had, in 1628, too great a resemblance to the massacre of St. Bartholomew in 1572. Finally, in addition to all this, this extreme measure, to which His Majesty, like a good Catholic, had no repugnance, always broke down before this argument of the besieging generals: La Rochelle is impregnable, except by famine. The cardinal was unable to dismiss from his own mind the fear which he entertained of his terrible emissary. For he also had understood the strange characteristics of that woman who was half lioness and half serpent. Had she betrayed him, or was she dead? He knew her well enough, in any case, to be assured that, whether she was acting for him or against him, whether enemy or friend, she could not remain inactive without very powerful obstructions. But whence could these obstructions arise? This was what he was unable to divine. After all, however, he had, with good reason, much confidence in her ladyship. he had suspected, in her past career, circumstances so terrible that his own red mantle was required to conceal them. And he felt that, from some cause or other, this woman was his own, because from him alone could she obtain support more potent than the danger which pursued her. The cardinal resolved, therefore, to conduct the war alone, and to expect aid foreign to himself only as one may expect the coincidence of a fortunate chance. He continued the construction of that famous embankment which was to carry famine into La Rochelle, and in the meantime he cast his eyes over that unhappy city, which contained so much profound misery and so many heroic virtues, recalling to his mind the expression of Louis the XI, who had been his own political predecessor, as he himself was the predecessor of Robespierre, and adopting this maxim of the companion of Tristran, "Divide to govern." When Henry VI besieged Paris, he had thrown over the walls bread and other edibles. The cardinal threw over brief addresses, in which he represented to the Rochellois how unjust and self-willed and barbarous had been the conduct of their chiefs, who possessed abundance of wheat, yet did not distribute it, and who adopted as a maxim, for they also had their maxims, that the death of women, of old men, and of children was a thing of little moment, so that the men who were to defend the walls continued vigorous and well. Until then, either from devotion or from inability to contend against it, this maxim had, without being generally adopted, passed from theory into practice, but these addresses successfully assailed it. They reminded the men that these women, children, and old men, who were allowed to die of hunger, were their wives, their offspring, and their sires, and that it would be more just if all were alike subjected to the common misery, so that a similarity of position might give occasion for unanimity of resolution. But, at the very moment that His Eminence saw his measure beginning to bear fruit, and was applauding himself for having adopted it, an inhabitant of Rochelle, who had arrived from Portsmouth, managed to pass through the royal lines, God knows how, so complete was the threefold watchfulness of Bassompierre, Schomberg, and the Duke of Angoulême, themselves overlooked by the cardinal, and announced that he had seen a splendid fleet ready to set sail before another week. Buckingham, moreover, declared to the mayor that the Great League against France was at last about to be proclaimed, and that the kingdom would be speedily invaded, at the same time by the armies of England, Spain, and the Empire. This letter was publicly read in all parts of the town. Copies of it were posted at the corners of the streets, and even those who had attempted to commence negotiations interrupted them with a resolution to wait for the succour which was so soon to reach them. This unexpected circumstance renewed all the original anxieties of Richelieu, and compelled him to turn his eyes once more across the sea. During all this time, the royal army, free from the inquietude of its only true commander, led a most joyous life, for provisions were not scarce in the camp, or money either. The regiments were all at rivalry in gaiety and audacity. To take spies and to hang them, to undertake the daring expeditions on the mole or the sea, to imagine follies and to execute them calmly. Such were the pastimes which made those days seem short to the army, while they were long not only for the Rochellois, who were worried by famine and anxieties, but for the cardinal, who blockaded them so vigorously. Sometimes, when the cardinal, who was always riding about like the humblest soldier of the army, directed his thoughtful eyes over the works which advanced so slowly in comparison to his desires, although constructed by engineers whom he had recruited from the remotest corners of France, if he met with a musketeer of Monsieur de Treville's company, he approached him and looked at him in a singular way. And then, not recognizing him as one of our four companions, he transferred to other objects his penetrating glance and his vast thoughts. One day, when consumed by a mortal lassitude of mind, without hopes of treating with the Rochellois, and without intelligence from England, the cardinal went forth, with no other aim but that of going out, and only accompanied by Cahusac and La Houdinière, wandering along the sands, and mingling the immensity of his own dreams with the immensity of the ocean, he came at a gentle pace to a small hill, from the top of which he perceived behind a hedge, reclining on the grass, and protected from the sun by a clump of trees, seven men, surrounded by empty bottles. Four of these men were our musketeers, getting ready to listen to the reading of a letter which one of them had just received. This letter was so important that it had made them desert some cards and dice which they had left upon a drum. The three others were the valets of the gentleman,
and were at the moment engaged in opening an enormous demijohn of Collioure wine. The cardinal, as we have said, was in a gloomy mood, and, when he was in this state of mind, nothing so much increased his sullenness as the gaiety of others. He had, besides,